How to dream faster.
Our epigraph is from The Undying by Anne Boyer.
Our century is excellent at the production of nightmares and terrible at the interpretation of dreams.
Section 1. Dreams and work. Dreams of work. Sleep and work.
How does work, be it waged or unwaged, seep into dream life? As work has changed, have dreams of work changed too? Do your bosses, your workspaces, or your colleagues assume new forms in your dreams? Is your sleep interrupted by or scheduled around working life? How does work restrict, determine, or structure the ways you sustain yourself? And how does that affect sleep and dream? How do transience, precarity, displacement, migration, and job insecurity affect how and in what environments and with whom people sleep and dream? How is the way you fall asleep and wake up conditioned by work? Is sleeping in a form of resistance to work, or is it just the result of having worked too much? Are anxieties about work or the lack of it heightened in dreams or dispelled? If I fall asleep at work, am I on strike? Are dreams sites of class struggle or sleepless nights the results of it? Can there be a worker's inquiry into sleep?
Do dreams and sleep sometimes become work? Not outside the capitalist circuit, but within it. How do graveyard shifts, night shifts, early morning starts, late night deadlines scramble your sense of day and night?
In The Working Day chapter of Capital, Volume 1, Karl Marx describes how the werewolf's hunger to generate value drove industrialists to maximise productivity by minimising the amount of sleep their workers could take.
Quote, "In the beginning of June 1836, information reached the magistrates of Dewsbury, Yorkshire, that the owners of 8 large mills in the neighbourhood of Batley had violated the Factory Acts. Some of these gentlemen were accused of having kept at work 5 boys between 12 and 15 years of age from 6 a.m. on Friday to 4 p.m. on the following Saturday, not allowing them any respite except for meals and 1 hour of sleep at midnight."
Even in what in Marx's time were already old-fashioned artisanal trades, he notes how the conditions of work conditioned conditions of sleep, both temporally and spatially.
"The work of a London journeyman baker begins, as a rule, at about 11 at night. At that hour, he makes the bread, a laborious process which lasts from half an hour to 3/4 of an hour. He then lies down upon the kneading board, which is also the cover of the trough in which the dough is made, and with a sack under him and another rolled up as a pillow, he sleeps for about a couple of hours. He is then engaged in a rapid and continuous labour for about 5 hours.
But such examples are not confined to the 19th century, although they take new forms in the 21st. Is any time truly separate from work? Do we perform functional tasks in dreams, continuing to work during sleep?
Sleep Workers' Inquiry, from Endnotes 2010.
This morning, floating through that state between sleep and consciousness, where you can become aware of the content of your dreams immediately before waking, I realized that I was dreaming in code again.
The writer here makes a distinction. Dreaming about your job is one thing. Dreaming inside the logic of your job is quite another. At work, you use the language of your job, the code. You resolve problems, make new code. Make money, you solve problems, become better at it, more productive, always productive. You do the same in sleep. You sleep with your phone under your pillow. It lights up throughout the night, like an image of a brain that lights up whilst dreaming. The language of dreams is the language of work. Here more specific, the language of computer coding.
I work in IT. I'm a web developer. One morning recently, I awoke with the thought of a bug in some code that I had written, a bug which I had not previously realised was there. My sleeping mind had been examining a week's work and had stumbled upon an inconsistency. Since I'm a thought worker, and since the identification and solution of such problems is the major aspect of my work, It is not that fantastical to say that I've been performing actual labour in my sleep. This is not the magical fecundity of some generalised creative power churning out value somehow socially beyond and ontologically before the labour process. It is actual work for capital, indistinguishable in character from that which I perform in my working day, but occurring in my sleeping mind. If labour becomes a mere habit of thought that can occur at any time, even in sleep, what hope is there here for the revolutionary overcoming of capitalism? What does our revolutionary horizon look like? Haitham al-Wadani's The Book of Sleep, 2016, describes how the slumbering working classes become the subject of bourgeois artworks and are thus consumed as a spectacle by the bourgeoisie.
The working class labours even in sleep. It labours in the image of the middle classes, both itself and its struggles reduced to pathetic subjects. Across the surface of uncountable paintings and photographs they slumber, labourers and peasant women, workmen and street children, laid down by exhaustion, laid out in their places of work, or sleeping propped up against one another on the pavement. The spectator observes them, some just beginning to be claimed by deep sleep, others simply letting their eyes rest. In these paintings and photographs, the sleep of the proletariat always happens in and around the workplace, since the proletariat has no right to a place of its own. It lives in the space from which it takes its name, the place of work. Nor does it have the right to its own time. There is no night or day, only endless hours of work, broken by snatched tumbles into exhausted sleep.
What is it that so attracts the middle class to the sleep of the working class? What in the sight of these bodies wearied to the point of sleep so excites them? Is it voyeurism, cheap compassion, perhaps the chance to exercise a self-appointed right of ownership? The sleep of the middle classes is always sheltered by walls and doors, but the sanctity of working class sleep is violated, spread out on the roadside. The sleep of the working class, which the middle classes document in their paintings and photographs, might excite pity. In the best case, it might prompt viewers to lend the workers a little sympathy. But by and large, it does not speak to the sleepers. Workers have no right to sleep from an unwillingness to work or out of idleness or discontent, nor even to sleep because they want to sleep. Their only right is to sleep wrecked by exhaustion and exertion, to remain a member of a mythic class which cannot change its conditions. The working class labours even in sleep. It labours in the images of the middle classes, both itself and its struggle reduced to pathetic subjects. Sympathies are marshalled, the status quo maintained.
E.P. Thompson's Time, Work Discipline and Industrial Capitalism from 1967 discusses how clock time became central to capitalist development, stretching not only the working day, but shaping all experience. Before the clock was introduced, time was measured not only by the sun's rise and fall, but also by more arbitrary measurements. Say not, I'll be gone for a minute, say, I'll be gone a pissing while. He also considered the gendered aspects of sleep and work. Quote, the most arduous and prolonged work of all was that of the labourer's wife in the rural economy. One part of this, especially the care of infants, was the most task-orientated of all. Another part was in the fields, from which she must return to renew domestic tasks. As Mary Collier complained in a sharp rejoinder to Stephen Duck.
When we home are come, alas, we find our work but just begun. So many things for our attendants call. Had we 10 hands, we could employ them all. Our children put to bed with greatest care. We all things for your coming home prepare. You sup and go to bed without delay, and rest yourselves till the ensuing day. While we, alas, but little sleep can have, because our froward children cry and rave.
But can dreams also be a kind of creative work that contrasts to the mundane realities of waking life? Can work outside of waking life be more productive? What would it mean to talk of dream productivity? Can the work of the imagination exist outside of capitalist demands?
Walter Benjamin, Surrealism, The Last Snapshot of the European Intelligentsia, 1929. The surrealist poet Saint-Paul Roux, retiring to bed to sleep at daybreak, fixes a notice on his door. Poet at work.
Do rhythms of work and the fatigue it produces structure the way people sleep and the kinds of dreams they have? This is a quote from Emile Zola's Germinal from 1885.
On the next day and the days that followed, Etienne continued his work at the pit. He grew accustomed to it. His existence became regulated by this labour and to these new habits which had seemed so hard to him at first. Only one episode interrupted the monotony of the first fortnight. A slight fever, which kept him in bed for 48 hours with aching limbs and throbbing head, dreaming in a state of semi-delirium that he was pushing his miner's tram in a passage that was so narrow that his body would not pass through. It was simply the exhaustion of his apprenticeship, an excess of fatigue from which he quickly recovered, and days followed days until weeks and months had slipped by. Now, like his mates, he got up at 3 o'clock, drank his coffee, and carried off the double slice of bread and butter prepared for him the night before.
How also do the experiences of work and the anxieties and dangers associated with working reappear in dreams?
Then Catherine fell. She had cried Cheval's name in despairing appeal. He did not hear. He was struggling, digging his heels into a comrade's ribs to get before him. And she was rolled down and trampled over. As she fainted, she dreamed. It seemed to her that she was one of the little potter girls of old days, and that a fragment of coal, fallen from the basket above her, had thrown her to the bottom of the shaft like a sparrow struck by a flint. 5 ladders only remained to climb. It had taken nearly an hour. She never knew how she reached daylight, carried on by people's shoulders, supported by the throttling narrowness of the passage. Suddenly she found herself in the dazzling sunlight, in the midst of a yelling crowd.
In the E.T.A. Hoffman fairy tale, The Mines of Falun, from 1819, the protagonist is told by a miner he meets at a festival about the wonders of mining. He had previously been motivated to work, to earn money, but all of his family had died, leaving him feeling depressed. The miner talks of the beautiful underground world of stone that miners explore. It is at this point in the tale that he dreams, and in the dream makes a promise that eventually seals his fate, and he too becomes a miner. Can dreams act as prophecies for the kinds of work we should pursue? Can the worker of the mountain extract the contents of dreams, exposing them to the light of day?
Tired and weary as he was, he had scarcely stretched out on his bed when a dream touched him with her wings. It seemed to him that he was drifting in a beautiful ship in full sail on a crystal clear sea, a heaven of dark clouds arching above him. But when he looked down into the waves, he realized that what he had thought was the sea was a solid, transparent, sparkling mass in the shimmer of which the whole ship dissolved in a marvelous manner, so that he was standing on a crystal floor, and above him he saw a dome of darkly gleaming minerals, which he had at first thought were clouds in the sky. Driven by an unknown power, he strode on. But at that moment, everything around him began to stir. And like curling waves, there shot up all around him marvellous flowers and plants of glittering metal, the blossoms and leaves of which curled upward from the depths and became intertwined in a most pleasing manner. The ground was so transparent that Ellis could see the roots of the plants, but when he looked down deeper and ever deeper, he saw in the depths innumerable charming female forms, who held each other locked in embrace with gleaming arms, and from their hearts there sprouted forth these roots and flowers and plants. When the maiden smiled, sweet harmony echoed through the dome, and the wondrous metal flowers thrust ever higher and became ever more gay. An indescribable feeling of pain and rapture seized the youth. A world of love, of desire, and of passionate longing expanded within him. Down to you, he cried, and he threw himself down with outspread arms onto the crystal ground, but it dissolved beneath him and he hovered in the shimmering air. Down to you, he cried, and he threw himself down with outspread arms onto the crystal ground, but it dissolved beneath him and he hovered in the shimmering air.
At this point, we asked everyone in the room if they wanted to share any dreams they might have had about work or at work. How has dream affected your sleep? Do you dream of your workplaces or fall asleep in them?
One thing I remember someone saying is that they worked at a library where part of their job involved stopping people from sleeping, policing sleep, waking people up who in most cases had no bed in which to fall asleep.
Section 2, on dreams as psychic work. Dream work is a major concept in psychoanalysis. Laplanche and Pontalis write a dictionary, not of dreams, but of psychoanalysis. They describe dream work, Traumarbeit, as
the whole of the operations which transform the raw materials of the dream, bodily stimuli, day's residues, dream thoughts, so as to produce the manifest dream. Distortion is the result of dream work.
They continue.
Freud maintains two complementary theses regarding the nature of the dream work. A. It is absolutely not creative, and it is restricted to the transformation of the material. B. It is the dream work, however, and not the latent content, defined as the repressed or hidden material, that determines what appears as the manifest content of dreams, which constitutes the essence of the dream.
In The Interpretation of Dreams from 1900, Freud uses the metaphor of a capitalist and an entrepreneur to help explain what happens in dreams. What could it mean when we attempt to think about dreams in relation to the non-metaphorical capitalist world?
To speak figuratively, it is quite possible that a day thought plays the part of the contractor, entrepreneur in the dream. But it is known that no matter what idea the contractor may have in mind, and how desirous he may be of putting it into operation, he can do nothing without capital. He must depend upon a capitalist to defray the necessary expenses, and this capitalist, who supplies the psychic expenditure for the dream, is invariably and indisputably a wish from the unconscious, no matter what the nature of the waking thought may be. In other cases, the capitalist himself is the contractor for the dream. This indeed seems to be the more usual case. An unconscious wish is produced by the day's work, which in turn creates the dream. The dream processes, moreover, run parallel with all the other possibilities of the economic relationship used here as an illustration. Thus, the entrepreneur may contribute some capital himself, or several entrepreneurs may seek the aid of the same capitalist, or several capitalists may jointly supply the capital required by the entrepreneur. Thus, there are dreams produced by more than one dream wish, and many similar variations which may readily be passed over.
Section 3, on daydreaming. Can dreams also be spaces beyond or without work? Are daydreams distractions from work, or can they help us imagine alternatives to work or new forms of work? Are daydreams or reveries ways of reflecting on the past, or can they imagine the future? What happens when you look out of the window at work? Are dreams of the future a kind of utopian space? Have you fallen into dream worlds, daydreams at work, to distract yourself from it, or even fallen asleep at work? Would this be a form of strike?
Ernst Bloch, The Principle of Hope, Volume 1, 1954. The castle in the air is not a stepping stone to the nocturnal labyrinth. If anything, the nocturnal labyrinths lie like cellars beneath the daytime castle in the air.
Kathy Weeks, The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries from 2011.
Daydreaming is often treated as an embarrassment, not only for the lack it represents, a lapse in concentration, a waste of time, an interruption of productive activity, but for what it reveals of our immoderate desires to be and have more, an excess of social desire comparable to the libidinal excesses that can fuel the sleeping dream. And it is not just that these desires for undeserved pleasures are seen as irredeemably self-indulgent. These experiments with the social and political imagination are also considered dangerous, risky violations of that strategy of social adjustment by which we allow ourselves to want only what we are likely to have. In this familiar estimation, daydreams are without value, neither sufficiently productive nor functionally reproductive to merit indulgence or warrant exploration.
Are daydreams a means of escape or a trap, a way of changing reality or of staying stuck in it?
Gustave Flaubert, Madame Bovary, 1856.
Though she had no one to write to, she had bought herself a blotter, a writing case, a pen, and envelopes. She would dust off her belongings, look at herself in the mirror, take up a book, and then begin to daydream and let it fall to her lap. She wanted to die, and she wanted to live in Paris.
Alexander Luria, The Mind of a Nemonist, 1968.
He lived in wait of something he assumed was to come his way, and gave himself up to dreaming and seeing far more than to functioning in life. The sense he had that something particularly fine was about to happen remained with him throughout his life, something which would solve all his problems and make his life simple and clear. He saw this and waited. Thus everything he did in life was merely temporary, what he had to do until the expected would finally come to pass.
Can daydreams break through all the anxieties and frustrations of the present to provide an image of a world without coercion and paranoia?
Jean-Jacques Rousseau, The Confessions from 1782.
I filled nature with being after my own heart. I created a golden age for myself to my own taste by recalling the experiences of earlier days with which sweet memories were associated, and by picturing in vivid colours the images of happiness for which I could then long. I imagined love and friendship, the two ideals of my heart, in the most delightful forms.
Can daydreams imagine a new society, a new waking life?
This, again, is from Zola's Germinal.
Since the good God was dead, justice would assure the happiness of men, and equality and brotherhood would reign. A new society would spring up in a day, just as in dreams. An immense town with the splendour of a mirage, in which every citizen lived by his work and took his share in common joys. The old rotten world had fallen to dust. A young humanity, purged from its crimes, formed but a single nation of workers, having for their motto, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. And this dream grew continually larger and more beautiful and more seductive as it mounted higher in the impossible.
Antonio Gramsci suggests that daydreaming at work, specifically when work is mechanized, is even a form of freedom. But what if machines simply replace human workers? Do androids dream of setting electric sheep free?
He writes, industrial work is not the spiritual death of man. Once the process of adaption has been completed, what really happens is that the brain of the worker, far from being mummified, reaches a state of complete freedom. The only thing that is completely mechanized is the physical gesture, the memory of the trade, reduced to simple gestures repeated at an intense rhythm, nestles in the muscular and nervous centres, and leaves the brain free for other occupations. Not only does the worker think, but the fact that he gets no immediate satisfaction from his work and realises that they are trying to reduce him to a trained gorilla can lead him into a train of thought that is far from conformist.
Workers might be exhausted by capitalism, but what if they resist sleep and instead use the night to plot against their bosses? Refusing sleep, the night becomes the space for struggling to abolish the structures of the working and waking day imposed on them by the ruling class. Only then could waking life truly be lived, and pursuits other than work become something more than mere leisure. When Maria, who initiated this event, told us about her film, she mentioned that some Lithuanian miners and workers in Scotland spent their nights producing a socialist newspaper, dreaming a world while they were awake, hoping to awaken from the nightmare of the historical circumstances imposed on them. Ranciere's Proletarian Nights discusses a similar phenomenon.
At precisely 8 o'clock on a night of October 1839, a meeting was called at the house of Martin Rose, the tailor, to establish a working man's newspaper. Finsard, the maker of measures, who writes songs for the singing club at the local bar, has invited Gowney, the carpenter, who expresses more taciturn temperaments and vengeful couplets. They write in an effort to delay, to the very last minute, that sleep which will restore the powers of the servile machine. The main subject of this book, Proletarian Nights, is those nights snatched from the normal sequence of work and sleep. They were imperceptible, one might almost say, inoffensive breaks in the ordinary course of things, where the impossible was already being prepared, dreamt and seen. The suspension of that ancient hierarchy which subordinates those dedicated to labour to those endowed with the privilege of thought. Section 4, on political dreams, dreams of the political, the world, and the end of the world.
Finally, on the eve of the election, we wanted to ask, what does it mean when the news or political events and figures appear in dreams? How are world historical events combined with personal experiences? On what scale do we dream? Are dreams big or small, collective or individual? Are these dreams usually nightmares, or at least ways of registering anxiety about current events that seem beyond our control? Have you ever dreamt about Trump? Are dreams spaces in which we seem stuck and everything seems unchangeable, or do they point ways out or suggest possibilities for social transformation?
Jackie Wang's Carceral Capitalism from 2018 includes a chapter epigraph by Asata Shakur. Quote, dreams and reality are opposites. Action synthesizes them. End quote. The following is a dream taken from Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook from 1962.
I dreamed marvelously. I dreamed there was an enormous web of beautiful fabric stretched out. It was incredibly beautiful, covered all over with embroidered pictures. The pictures were illustrations of the myths of mankind, but they were not just pictures, they were the myths themselves, so that the soft glittering web was alive. There were many subtle and fantastic colours, but the overall feeling this expanse of fabric gave was of redness, a sort of variegated glowing red. In my dream, I handled and felt this material and wept with joy. I looked again and saw that the material was shaped like a map of the Soviet Union. It began to grow. It spread out, lapped outwards like a soft glittering sea. It included now the countries around the Soviet Union, like Poland, Hungary, etc. But at the edges, it was transparent and thin. I was still crying with joy, also with apprehension. And now the soft red glittering mist spread over China, and it deepened over China into a hard, heavy clot of scarlet. And now I was standing out in space somewhere, keeping my position in space with an occasional downtreading movement of my feet in the air. I stood in a blue mist of space while the globe turned, wearing shades of red for the communist countries and a patchwork of colours for the rest of the world. Now I was very frightened and I had a sick feeling, as if I was being invaded by some feeling I didn't want to admit. I was too sick and dizzy to look down and see the world turning. Then I look and it is like a vision. Time has gone and the whole history of man, the long story of mankind, is present in what I see now. And it is like a great soaring hymn of joy and triumph in which pain is a small lively counterpoint. And I look and see that the red areas are being invaded by the bright different colours of the other parts of the world. The colours are melting and flowing into each other, indescribably beautiful, so that the world becomes whole, all one beautiful glittering colour, but a colour I have never seen in life. This is a moment of almost unbearable happiness. The happiness seemed to swell up, so that everything suddenly bursts, explodes. I was suddenly standing in peace, in silence. Beneath me was silence. The slowly turning world was slowly dissolving, disintegrating and flying off into fragments, all through space, so that all around me were weightless fragments drifting about, bouncing into each other and drifting away. The world had gone, and there was chaos. I was alone in chaos, and very clear in my ear a small voice said, "Somebody pulled a thread of the fabric and it all dissolved." I woke up, joyful and elated.
The book Green and Women Everywhere, Dreams, Ideas and Actions from the Women's Peace Movement from 1983, gathers examples of dreams dreamt by women involved in the Greenham Common Peace Camp, who were protesting at the US Air Force's use of RAF Greenham Common as a site for nuclear weapons. This is a dream from that collection.
It was a bright grey winter's day. There was, to my knowledge, half an hour to go before the bomb dropped. I was walking, stumbling down a country lane, naked hawthorns on either side. I was with my two children. I felt at once calm, philosophic. There's only half an hour to go anyway. I mustn't frighten the children. I could cope with death, whether it came suddenly or unknowingly or slowly and tragically. Watching my dearest girls ill, knowing my far-flung, unreachable friends and family to be suffering too. If only was the crutch. If only meant, if only I could know that the sick fields and waters and trees and mountains could renew someday. If only the bare hawthorns could leaf again. So thinking, I looked lovingly at the twigs and branches. Clearly, in sharp, tender focus, young, small, green leaves sprang into sight. Their pale, unfurling vulnerability, their promise of hope, their pledge of spring and rebirth pierced me with emotion. I still knew that there was half an hour to go and that the world could not, would not revive. The eternal promise of the leaves had been betrayed and I awoke. I was startled to find that my predominant emotion was that of wonder and gratitude that I had been able to see those beautiful leaves before the world died. Then the account continues.
We test the reality of the world we have woken up to against the reality of the dream world we have left. We wake up and realise that the monsters who pursued us such a short time ago are not actually in the room. Dreams about nuclear war are different in this respect from other dreams. There is no waking from the nightmare. We wake and know the threat of nuclear war is a real one. But however real these threats, our dreams can still reach beyond present reality and through it to create a life in which the day truly becomes the day, the night truly the night, a life beyond or without work, a world in which our nights, our days, our dreams and our daydreams are no longer disciplined and coerced, but our fantasies and desires are unleashed to fall asleep without setting an alarm, or to hear that alarm every single waking minute.